Well, let's continue our study of the life of David. David, of course, that very young boy, young man, mid-teens probably, famous for the slaying of Goliath, the one who had been secretly anointed to be the future king of Israel whilst Saul, the first king of Israel, was still on the throne. Saul had made quite a good start, but then declined, both as a king and also as a godly man. And God made it clear that he was to be removed from the throne and that God had removed his favor from him. After David's success over Goliath, of course, his fame and his acclaim just grew and grew. And that song that was quoted again in the chapter we've just read about David slaying his tens of thousands compared to Saul's thousands really kind of epitomized the way that the people were thinking about him. And Saul became increasingly envious of David. He wasn't like that to begin with, of course, when David first slew Goliath. Well, David was the flavor of the month, even in Saul's mind. But that didn't last that long. And very quickly, Saul's envy, because he fostered it, it very quickly grew to hatred, to the point where Saul wanted David done away with. He wanted this man killed. And he's already sent out basically what were execution squads to hunt David down and to seek to take his life. And up to now, God has spared him. David, of course, has struck up this remarkable friendship with Saul's son, Jonathan. Jonathan, quite understandably, is finding it difficult to believe the things that David is saying about his dad. David has said to Jonathan, "Your dad is out to kill me." That's hard for a son to hear about his own father. Jonathan struggles. We've skipped over chapter 20 of 1 Samuel, but that chapter talks about that struggle that Jonathan has as David tries to convince him that his dad really is out to take his life. And Jonathan finds it very hard to accept. And so they strike up a plan between themselves. There's a feast due to take place when the new moon is in the sky, and it would be expected that David would be at that feast. And David decides to make himself absent. And David is confident that Saul will display to Jonathan his hatred by him being absent at that feast. Jonathan's not convinced, but David is proved correct. Saul becomes furious at David's absence. And Jonathan realizes just how bad Saul's anger is when, well, remember that spear that on several occasions Saul has thrown at David to try and kill him. Well, Saul picks up a spear and throws it at Jonathan, his own son, and tries to kill him. Such is his anger. Well, that's when Jonathan realizes, oh, David's been telling the truth. And some of you will know the story. There's been a prearranged way that Jonathan will convey to David the outcome of the meeting that Jonathan has had with his dad. David is hiding in a field. Jonathan goes out to do some archery practice and shoots his arrow into the field. And a prearranged message that David shouts to his servant lets David know that Saul is indeed out to get him. And David knows he has to flee. That was chapter 20 that we haven't read, but that's the summary of that chapter. And David really is now a full-blown outlaw. He is on the run for his life. And chapter 21, the opening verse, he arrives at where the tabernacle is located, Ahimelech, the priest is there. And we have this account of what takes place. And this evening, I want us to see that what we're witnessing in chapter 21 is a gradual spiritual decline in David. There are glimmers of light. We'll come to that in a moment. but we're seeing a spiritual decline in David. We see it demonstrated in his conduct, the kinds of things he's doing, and the kind of things he's not doing. Now, if you know anything of the story, you know that the worst is yet to come. And you know that God demonstrates just what a gracious God he is in that David is restored. But there are some really practical warnings for us as Christians, because I think the things that David struggles with, the kind of temptations that he faces, the kinds of things that bring about this period of spiritual decline, it is only a period of spiritual decline in his life. Well, we can learn from that. And we're going to conclude by considering a few verses from the New Testament, where I believe the Apostle Paul is really homing in on the very kinds of things that were going on in David's life that can affect you and I just as easily. So what can we see that give us this insight that there's a real spiritual battle going on in David's life, that right now he's really not winning and he's really struggling spiritually? Well, I just want to point out five things from that chapter that we saw. The first is when he first arrives and meets with Ahimelech. David invents a story to justify his arrival. It is not the truth. David has not been sent by the king. David is running for his life. I suspect most of us have done this at one time or another. We feel we need to justify or explain a position that we've arrived to in our lives. And so in order to do that, we invent a little story. It's just a little white lie. There might be some truth in it, but we've only told half the truth, just so that people see it from a certain perspective, which actually is false. Or maybe, like David has done here, he simply invents a story. It's a cover story that sounds plausible. He doesn't want to admit to Ahimelech that he's on the run because Saul is out to kill him. And so he just invents this story. It's not a huge act of deceit in that sense, but it is deceit. And he just makes up this cover story. How quickly the human heart wants to do that. And that's what he does there in verse 2. Of course, Ahimelech believes him. Why should he doubt him? This is David. But it's not the truth. And that gives us a hint, quite a big one, that spiritually things aren't well in David's life right now. The second thing we see is when David asks for the showbread. Now, this is an interesting account, really. He hasn't gone immediately in and asked for it. He's just asked for bread, 5 loaves. You might say, well, what about, it says that David's on his own in verse 1. Why are you alone? But then there are some young men with him. Well, I think the why are you alone is, why aren't you with your army? Why is there just you and these few young men, when surely, when David arrives, we expect other army captains and officers to be with him and a huge entourage to be with David. How come it's just you and, well, just a few young men? I think that's the distinction that is being made for us there. David doesn't specifically go in and ask for the showbread, but when he's made aware that only the showbread is available, he asks for it. Now, on the one hand, that's something that David shouldn't have done. The showbread was put on a platter in the tabernacle, and it was renewed once a week. 12 loaves of bread, representing, of course, the 12 tribes of Israel, and it was symbolic of the presence of God. And every week, 12 fresh loaves of bread were put on display. They would remain there permanently throughout the next week, and then they would be replaced again. And as the old loaves of bread were removed, in Leviticus, you can read about this, They became the property of the priests and they could use them for food. But it was only the priests that were permitted to use it. And David is asking for something that really only the priests should have. And he's really putting Ahimelech in a very awkward situation. Ahimelech's conscience probably is really going to be torn over this issue. So on a number of levels, we can see that David really shouldn't be asking for this. But at the same time, David actually gives a hint that all is not totally lost with him spiritually, because he actually sees something spiritually that Jesus himself actually will commend in Matthew chapter 12. When Jesus is accused with his disciples by the Pharisees, Jesus refers back to this event of David. In Matthew 12, it's on the Sabbath day, and Jesus and his disciples are plucking grain on the Sabbath day as they're walking along, and the Pharisees challenge them. Shouldn't be doing that on the Lord's day. And the first thing that Jesus mentions is this event when David used the showbread from the tabernacle to feed himself. And basically what is being said is, look, that bread did have a symbolic purpose in the tabernacle. But given the choice between leaving starving men to starve and not take the bread, or allowing them to use the bread and feed themselves, the right thing to do is to allow them to use that bread and feed themselves. Yes, that bread has been set aside for a special place in the tabernacle, but it would be wrong to deny starving men that bread. And David does actually say it is, in effect, just common bread. And that actually is what Jesus is saying in Matthew 12. So it does show us that all is not lost with David. There is still some spiritual life in the man. You see, God never allows his people to totally fall away. If you truly are one of the Lord's people, you will never completely fall away. Because he never loses his own. You're always in his hand. That's encouraging, isn't it? Even as we see this period where David is really struggling spiritually, there is nevertheless sign of spiritual life. That's a great encouragement. It is to me, and I hope that is to you, because that is always the reality for those who are truly the Lord's. He will never completely let go of you. You will never be lost once you are his. And so that's an encouragement to us. So it's a bit of a strange event that takes place there, but I believe it's some help to us as we look at David's life. The next thing, the third thing that we see in David, is he asks for a sword. And lo and behold, Ahimelech's got one. And even more amazing, guess whose sword it is? Goliath's. The very sword that David took hold of and chopped off Goliath's head. And there it is, wrapped in a cloth in the tabernacle. Presumably it's been there ever since the battle took place. And you think, hang on. What's happened to David? 1 Samuel chapter 17, 4 chapters previous. And this is what we read. David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. But I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied." Where's that David gone? He now wants the sword that he defeated with a stone and a sling, with God on his side. Isn't that remarkable? He's now putting his confidence in a sword that he defeated with a single stone. Where is there any evidence in this chapter of David seeking God? He hasn't even sought to seek God through the priest Ahimelech. And now he's putting his confidence in the things of this world that he has already seen defeated by the power and might of God. And how easily we can find ourselves doing the same kind of thing. Putting our confidence in the things of this world, where once perhaps we did stand. Megan was sharing about that young girl, 11 or 12 years old. Well, it's really hard in school, but God's on my side. Well, that was David, but he's disappeared. He's not here at the moment in this story. The fourth thing we see, you're beginning to notice things are declining and declining, because the next thing is he seeks refuge amongst the ungodly. He's actually now arrived at a Philistine king to seek refuge and help, which is remarkable, isn't it? The very opening psalm, which we don't think was written by David, nevertheless says this: "Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night." Oh, David's really struggling. Maybe you've been there. Maybe you've been to that place that David is at. And he's neglecting his spiritual life to the point now where he seeks refuge amongst the ungodly. He's gone to the very sworn enemy of Israel to seek refuge with Achish, the king of Gath, the hometown of Goliath. So David finds himself carrying Goliath's sword, putting his trust in that. And now at Goliath's hometown, putting his trust in that, speaking to the Philistine king and putting his hope in him. How did he end up like that? And then fifthly, he totally humiliates himself. He hears the people talking about him. He realizes that these people know exactly who I am. And clearly, he feels that now his life is in danger. This was a bad mistake. Shouldn't have come here. They're going to kill me. What can I do? Well, he pretends to be insane. And he just totally humiliates himself and starts behaving in the most dreadful way. What a shameful thing for a godly man to do, to feign madness and to allow yourself to look like you're a dribbling wreck. What a tremendous picture of degradation. And David's done that to himself, behaving as if he's lost his mind. Well, I think this whole chapter is just a salutary warning to us of where the godly can very quickly find themselves. This is still God's man. And we know God hasn't finished with him. And God will not abandon him. And God will restore him. But he's just not behaving the way the godly David of a few chapters ago used to behave. How do we account for this? How is this explained? And some of you, I'm sure, will have recognized some of the kinds of things that David's struggling with. You may have not ended up in the kind of position that David's in, but I'm sure you've recognized some of those temptations that we face. Maybe to just the temptation to just, well, let's just embellish the truth slightly just to get myself out of this little jam that I've got myself into. Well, let's just trust this thing where really I should be trusting the Lord. Those kinds of issues that we struggle with. How's that explained? How is that explained that Christians have those same kinds of troubles and difficulties that David has? Is there an explanation for it? Well, yes, there is. And I just want to conclude by just turning you to a few scriptures in the New Testament, because the Apostle Paul was all too aware of these kinds of battles and difficulties and struggles that Christians like you and me and godly men like David face. And far more regularly than most of us would care to admit. There is an answer. And there's some great help. There's some great warnings and instruction in the Bible that will help us to deal with these kinds of things. Let's turn first of all to the book of Galatians in chapter 5. Because the Apostle Paul makes us aware of certain truths that we need to understand and grasp as Christian people. Galatians chapter 5, beginning at verse 16. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now, Paul is talking to Christian believers when he says this. And he says, look, the reality in every Christian is that there's an inner battle that goes on. We remain in our fleshly, sinful bodies once we're saved. And yes, it's wonderfully true, all the things that Christ comes and does, and we're set free from the dominion of sin. But we still struggle with these wretched earthly bodies, sinful bodies that respond to temptation and that too easily want to slide back to the way things used to be. Paul says this is a reality for Christian people. In Romans chapter 7, he says this: what I am doing, I do not understand, for what I will to do, that I do not practice. But what I hate, that I do. If then I do what I will not to do, I agree with the law that it's good, but now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. So he's saying that even though I'm a saved man, even though I'm a Christian, there is still this battle taking place. God's Spirit has come into me. God's Spirit now is the dominant power and force in my life. But I still have these sinful struggles going on within me. And he concludes that little section at verse 24 by saying, oh, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? So there's this struggle taking place. Now, Paul, having just said that about these struggles that he takes place, bear in mind that this is the man who also says this about his own Christian experience. I became a minister according to the gift of the grace of God given to me by the effective working of his power. And he talks elsewhere about the power of God working in me mightily. So Paul confronts us with these two sets of truths that as Christians we need to hold in balance in our thinking. We mustn't allow the one to become so dominant that it obliterates the other. On the one hand, we have been made new in Christ. We've become new creatures. We are now no longer under the dominion and the domination of sin. Christ now, by his Spirit, is the dominant, active, working force in our lives. But that does not mean that we can just become passive and sit back and think, okay, God's in me now. I don't have to do anything else. I don't have to worry about anything else. I don't have to think about anything else. God is in me. He will do it. That's all I need to know. Because that can't be all I need to know. Because otherwise, if that was all I need to know, that would be the only thing that the Apostle Paul had to say on the subject. But it isn't. Because over and over and over again, he talks about these battles that we face. And he talks about the responsibility that I have to take in living the Christian life. Those two things have to be held in balance together. We're going to have a look at one of those passages where he talks about the need for me as a Christian man to have my brain in gear, to think about things, to be diligent, to be vigilant, to remain spiritually awake and alert, to learn, to use all the means of grace that God has given me that I might grow. And yes, the reason any of that can happen is because of the grace and the power of God that is within me. Without God's grace, without God's power, none of it can happen. And I will get nowhere. But there still are things for me to be aware of, conscious of, and diligent in. And so that is why, in places like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the Apostle Paul exhorts people. He's constantly exhorting people. You should no longer be living like this. Your conduct should no longer look like that. Now, as a Christian man or woman, you should be like this. You should be like that. Now, if it was just only about the power of God being at work in me, Paul would have no need to say any of those things because God will just do it. You don't have to worry. But that's not the case. God holds me accountable for how I live my Christian life. When I stand before God on Judgment Day, I will not be condemned for my sins, but I will have to give an account for how I've lived a Christian life for Christ. Because God holds me responsible for that. We have to have these truths in balance in our thinking. And so Paul says, therefore, verse 12 of 1 Corinthians 10, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. Because I have a responsibility in my life, living as a Christian man, by God's power and by God's grace. When Paul is writing to the elders in Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, elders of the church. Now surely, once you've become an elder, well, you're so far on your way to being there, you've no need to worry, have you? Take heed unto yourselves, is his first exhortation to the elders of the churches. Take heed unto yourselves. Because it's very easy to become a David. It's very easy to become a David. In Ephesians chapter 4, Paul gives us this passage with these warnings, beginning at verse 20. You have not so learned Christ, if indeed you have heard him, and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct, the old man. Verse 23, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Now, you can't produce that renewal yourself. It needs the grace and the power of God by his Spirit to do that. But nevertheless, we are active in it as well. Verse 24, that you put on the new man. Paul doesn't say, don't worry about a thing. God will take off your old man. God will put on your new man. You don't need to do anything. God will do it all. He doesn't say that, does he? He says, you take off. You put on. God is in you and with you, and by his grace and power you can. That's why I'm giving you the instruction. But you have this responsibility. It's you and God working together. Put on this new man, true righteousness and holiness. Chapter 6, verse 11, put on the whole armour of God. God's given you everything that you need. Don't forget to put it on. Don't neglect. Don't abandon all of those means of grace that God has made available to you, that you may grow thereby. David is just an amazing warning for each one of us that are Christians here this evening, that such a man could end up in such a state, a slobbering wreck, frightened, finding his home amongst his enemies, running for his life. A godly man can end up that way. Well, I think we find exactly those same exhortations in the New Testament scriptures for godly people today. But the great encouragement for us is that, as I pointed out in David's life, there is evidence still of spiritual life there. God will never abandon his people. He will never let go. We might grieve him. He'll never let us go. And if we will just heed the warnings of the scripture, if we really will take heed unto ourselves, remain diligent in all the means of grace that God has given us. He's given us them for a reason, that we might learn and grow and be useful and fruitful for his glory and his praise. Let's heed the clear warnings that the Bible gives us. Hold fast to the principles that the scriptures provide for remaining firm in our faith and remaining clear and strong in witness, for walking faithfully and diligently, because despite all the difficulties, the grace and the power of God is at work in each one of you, and in Christ, with his life in you, you can stand firm, you can stand secure in him, and to know that you are living your life to his glory and to his praise. And may God help each one of us to have that testimony and to know his protecting and providing hand upon us day by day.